This is the Family Culture Movement. Are you ready to break up with the dysfunctional beliefs and behaviors of our dominant culture and parent with intention? Then you're in the right place. The Family Culture Movement is where you'll learn how to take inventory of the narratives and social conditioning shaping your family dynamics and say no to the dominant culture. I'm your host, Jody Chafee. I'm going to help you break dysfunctional patterns and lead your family with confidence and resilience. Hey, if this is your first time tuning in, be sure to check out the last episode of the Family Culture Movement with Megan Smith, when we talked about what it means to plant seeds in your family culture. Today's guest is Michaela Foster Marsh, author of the book Star Child, a memoir about Michaela's life with her adopted brother, Frankie, and Michaela's journey to learn more about Frankie after his tragic death by finding his birth family in Uganda. Michaela is an acclaimed musician with 3 albums to her credit and the founder of the executive director of Star Child Charity. She lives in Glasgow, Scotland, and has received a Prime Minister's Award for her work in Uganda. Welcome to the show, Michaela.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm excited to talk to you about your experience with your adopted brother, Frankie, and how it inspired you to go to Uganda to find his birth parents. So let's go back to the beginning and where it started. What inspired your parents to adopt Frankie?
Well, it was 1966 at the time, and they had put on the adoption certificate the forms that they would like a hard-to-place child, meaning a child that perhaps had a disability or was a bit older, because at that time, everybody wanted brand new babies. A lot of the older children were being left behind. And also, as you can imagine, children with disabilities, it wasn't every family that would want to take that on. So they had said that they were happy to take a hard-to-place child. And at that time, there was a little black boy who came into the home. And by that point, Frankie was now 13 months old, and he had become hard-to-place. And obviously, being black in the 60s in Glasgow, transracial adoption was literally unheard of. So, but my parents said they really didn't care what color Frankie was, as long as they felt there was a bond there. So they went to see Frankie at one of the children's homes in Kilmarnock, which is just outside of Glasgow. And I think it was love at first sight. But the adoption agency were really concerned that Frankie and I were identical in age. There was only 4 weeks between us. And so they thought there could be a lot of territorial issues having 2 young, babies really. Him coming into my territory could be a problem. So he came originally as a foster child. And at that time, just to put it into perspective, we were dealing with the civil rights movement in America. And in 1968 was the year that Frankie was actually adopted. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. So I think it was really brave of my parents. They were taking a very quiet anti-racism stance at that point. Now, things were filtering over into Scotland, but it certainly had not reached the fever pitch that it was in the US.
Right.
But we were well aware of everything through the media and the TV. Exactly the same thing is now happening, of course, with George Floyd having been murdered. We're seeing those riots again. And I mean, I used to say to people about the timing, like when my parents had adopted Frankie and how brave it was. And it kind of just went over people's head and they didn't really connect with it or really fully appreciate or understand what my parents had actually, the stance they'd taken at that time. So it's only now that people are beginning to actually go, oh, wow, your parents adopted Frankie during that time. But really, it was a very unusual thing for them to have done. But at that time, I must say, in Scotland, in Glasgow, it was more curiosity. People would stop my mum in the street. She would have a buggy, twin buggy, and they would stop and say, I'm milk bottle white, freckles and red hair.
Like,
and then exactly. And then she's got this little cute, so adorable Frankie, sitting next to me. And so everybody would stop and go, wow, look, oh my gosh, you know, like, can I touch him? You know, can I touch his hair? Can we pick him up? I mean, my mum would say that it was like he was a soft toy, you know. So that, I think that was actually quite difficult for her in hindsight, because she hadn't long had me. And then, you know, every new mother wants her, you know, their child to be adored and everything. And, you know, so I'm not looking for the sympathy vote, you know, at all. But it was like, I think for my mum, she felt, you know, oh, what's wrong with my child? And I think that was overlooked by the adoption agents. I don't think they realised how much attention a black child would cause to the family at that particular point in time, because nobody had ever really seen it.
Yeah.
And they were curious. And of course, they thought that maybe dad had gone out on some mission to Africa or something. And it was so not the case. It was the case that Frankie had actually been left in Scotland by Ugandan students. So in 1962, when Uganda got independence, it sent its really bright students to get an education in the UK. And Frankie's mum had been one of those students, and she was in Belfast studying, came over to Scotland to have the child in secrecy. And, you know, gave birth to Frankie in Scotland, and then had to very, from what I understand, reluctantly give Frankie up for adoption and return to her studies in Belfast. And so, I mean, I think it must have been all written in the stars before, you know, for Frankie to have come to our family. And, you know, he was just, for me, we were twins in every sense of the word. We were twins. Albeit that we were different in colour, we were extremely close.
Yeah.
As close as I think any biological twin could possibly be. And we told our teachers we were twins when we walked into the class. And it stuck.
That's awesome.
Uh-huh. You know, I really, you know, I went in and just said, you know, we're twins. And everybody laughed. And, you know, they were like, are you sure about that? And I was like, absolutely. We're twins. And so we did that all through high school. And even when we were in bars and clubs when we were older, people would think we were dating and we would be like, no, we're twins. So it's really confused.
That's awesome. That's such a beautiful story, Michaela, because it really speaks to your parents' credit that they were willing to put on their adoption papers that they would accept any baby that they would, or any child, whether or not, you know, it's fascinating to me how, you know, these children need a place, they need a family. And yet the adopted families are going, well, I only want such and such these demographics or these credentials and things like that. But it's like, man, that child didn't choose to be in this world and not have a family, you know? And so it's like, that really speaks to your parents' credit that they were, sound like very compassionate, very good people that they wanted to take anybody and, you know, it sounds to me like they kind of lucked out though. That Frankie wasn't like a special needs or.
He was, no, Frankie just was adorable. And we did luck out. I mean, no adoption comes without its problems, and no transracial adoption comes without its problems. And, you know, you could do a full podcast just on that,
I'm sure.
You know, and obviously the book, I go into a lot of that, but only from really my own perspective and what I could gather from my own parents. And of course, in those days, there was really no help, you know, for that, because it was unusual. People weren't doing it. So, and even adoption, there was really,
yeah, I was going to say
help.
Adoption is pretty, rare. Anyways,
it was all cloaked in secrecy. And I mean, well, that really takes me to why I think I ended up in Uganda in the end, because Frankie was kind of almost oddly incurious about his parenting, who his biological family were. I mean, my parents did sit down with us when we were about 10 and said, do you want to know anything? Or my dad had sort of opened up this, you know, whole conversation dialogue. And my dad had been adopted himself and he didn't know who his father was. And so, you know, I think my dad was very open to all of that. I think he did want to adopt much more than my mum. I think my mum was kind of talked into it, to be honest. But I mean, she didn't need much talking into. I mean, she did definitely fall in love with Frankie. But there was definite issues and problems along the way. It wasn't easy. But when we sat down with Frankie and my parents, we sat down and talked to him. He didn't want to know. I don't want to know them. They didn't want to know me. I'm Scottish. very defensive about being Scottish. And, you know, I think that perhaps at that stage in Frankie's life, he couldn't identify with an African culture. He couldn't identify with his colour. As far as he was concerned, he was white. He grew up in a white family. There weren't very many other black children around in Scotland at that particular point. In his school, he was the only black child. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think he might have felt that he was about 10. I think he might have felt that he was going to be sent to Africa or something.
Oh, wow.
You can imagine how scary that would be for a child, you know, to think, oh, you're my family, but I'm suddenly going to get maybe put over to Uganda, into a foreign country that I don't understand. And I mean, the news at that time wasn't brilliant if you watched anything. And our culture was so different from on the TV. So I think he was scared, and also scared of maybe losing the family and losing our parents' love. So it wasn't until he got older that he became a bit more curious about all of that. But you see, my curiosity from a child, you know, from the day, there was one really telling moment. We were in the bathtub. We used to get washed in the bathtub together. And Frankie said to my mum, if I scrub really hard, will I become white like Michaela?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's such a telling statement. And until that point, we were 5 years old. And until that point, I don't think I really realized that Frankie was a different color.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think children aren't born racist and they don't see color that way. So Frankie was just, he's my first memory. And I just remember Frankie's my brother. He's black.
Yeah.
Then as I got older, I was obviously processing, oh yeah, you know, I'm white, you're black, mum's white. And, you know, my mum was really quick about trying to explain to Frankie about, you know, the melanin in the skin, and he came from Africa and his biological family, and made it sound really like a fairy tale almost. And I became so curious about his family and who this woman was, you know, who these black people were, because, I mean, I just love Frankie's colour, you know. Yeah. So I was then thinking, oh, they're part of my family too, because Frankie's my twin.
Yeah.
So his family are my family, but where are his family? They're in Africa, but yet my brother doesn't want to know anything about them, but I want to know lots about them. I want to know all about his family.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So that was a paradox of it, was that I was like, oh, I wonder what Africa's like. I want, you know, because my brother comes from there. Yeah. Frankie was going, I'm Scottish. I don't want to know anything about my African family.
So that's a really cool dynamic, though, to think about. Like, when you adopt a child, they are yours. They become your family, and your siblings see each other as siblings and family members, especially when, you know, you said you were only 13 months old when he was adopted. You were both about 13 months old. And I mean, that's like, you don't remember anything before 3 years
old. I have no memory before Frankie.
Yeah. So I love this idea and that he was your brother. And and you know, so many families out there, you know, who are adopting, or you know, I know lots of people who are doing foster care and things like that, you know, that it's just such an important thing to understand, I think, how the adoption process happens or how it impacts your family and the dynamics of your family, because I think that it's something that more people should advocate for, right? Like, we should be willing and able or wanting to, you know, give children good homes and recognizing that when we bring these children into our homes, they become family, and that's powerful.
They do. But the adopted child, again, like I say, this could be a whole podcast in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
The adopted child is carrying trauma because they've been separated from that biological mum. And whether or not Frankie was admitting it, almost his defense was really the giveaway as well.
Interesting.
You know, like, he was not prepared to kind of admit that, but that there's that. Doesn't matter if you're taken from right from birth, you're severing from that woman who you depended on for life 2 minutes before. And so you can't underestimate the trauma of an adopted child and that sense and fear of abandonment. And I think that that is also where Frankie was worried that, you know, you're my family. I want to hold on to you. I love you, and don't send me anywhere else. Because, you know, he probably thought that he could have been. And what I also uncovered, which is in the book, because the journey, I mean, it's just miraculous how it all unfolded and how I came to find the family. But I also discovered that Frankie had actually, like I was saying, he was born in 66, but my parents were introduced to him. He was 13 months old when he came to live with us. Mm-hmm. So that period in between, there was a gap, and he had actually been fostered already and given back because the parents said, we do not want you. The grandparents say, their parents had said, if you adopt this black child, we'll disown you.
Wow.
So that's, racism was there. And don't get me wrong, there was racism in Scotland. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
But we were lucky until he got a bit older and to that. But he suffered from that racism there because that family had to give Frankie back because their parents said, we don't think this is right. You can't adopt that child. If you adopt that child, you know, we'll give you up, you know. So Frankie was given back into the system.
Yeah.
So, and that was all hidden. It was all covered up because then the adoption agency, it was more, I think, to protect Frankie and also to protect potential parents in case they thought he was a bad child. And I think that adopted children sometimes do feel they're being a bad child. What did I do wrong? You know, and that's in their psyche anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I must have done something wrong because my mom gave me up. So, you know, if you compound that in Frankie's situation where he had already been out on a foster and then given back, you know, at least that's what I believe from the paperwork has happened. I don't have 100% proof, but from that and the conversation that I had with my mum when she was dying, we believe that was covered up. So he'd already been through enormous trauma by the time we got Frankie. But despite that, he was just so, you know, charismatic, bubbly. He just didn't have a chip on his shoulder. He didn't carry that pity. You know, being adopted and being black in a white society like he was, it was a white family, you could have a big chip on your shoulder. Frankie didn't. He had a great sense of humor. He just looked at people as if they were going to see past his color. And even when there were problems, he could usually divert the tension through humor. And he never went looking for a fight, but he was good with his fists if he had to. You know, he would fight. He wasn't afraid to fight, but he didn't go looking for trouble. And he was very protective of the family, very protective of me. But the race stuff didn't happen till we were a bit older and we were, you know, at high school. Mm-hmm. At the actual school itself, again, Frankie was so loved. He just had a charm about him, a natural grace and charm, very attractive, good-looking man. But when you took him outside the school environment, we were starting to go to nightclubs, discos, pubs, things like that. You know, maybe the youth fellowships, things like that. It started. And then a couple of times he got arrested for crimes that he didn't commit. And the police would come to the school and he'd be really embarrassed. And I mean, I remember one time I kind of ran out of class and went over to we had these red phone booths at that time. And I phoned my dad and said, Frankie's been taken away. And I honestly think that if my dad was not wearing a dog collar, you know, a clerical collar, and was white, we would have had a much harder time getting Frankie out of there. And when my dad questioned them about it, the police would just say, well, they all look to us.
Say that part again.
They all look the same to us.
Rude.
It is.
Wow.
They just think that black people all look the same. So to say that we did suffer racism, there was, you know, a party we were at one night where a knife got wielded in front of us and he was called a black bee and all the rest of it. Again, his friends would have defended him to the death. And he somehow, I mean, I was there that night and it was absolutely terrifying. But he somehow, and I've got all this in the book, but he somehow managed to kind of, you know, I'm not looking for trouble, da da da, you know, and his friends came to the forefront, and we diverted. Yeah. My parents were always, I mean, when I got the call that Frankie died, and you know, my first thought is he's been murdered, he's been stabbed in a club because somebody doesn't like the colour of his skin. I mean, it was a fire. It was an accidental fire. It was extremely sad, the circumstances. But I think, I mean, my parents must have gone to bed some nights really worried.
Yeah, yeah.
But they never allowed it to stop us from living our lives. They were actually really cool about us going out to parties and clubs and things. And, you know, but 9 times out of 10, we were absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. He could charm the pants off people, you know, and people just loved him. But at the same time, there's always those, a small group, a minority, but it's there.
Yeah.
And it's horrible. And when you look at that face of racism, you're staring it in the face as we've done. And you love that person. I cannot for the life of me understand why some people feel like that.
Yeah.
They do. And well, it is
fear
very
what we
real.
Don't know. I think, you know, like you said, he was the only black kid in your school. And, you know, there's a lot of fear around judgment and racism and other prejudice that people form, right? There's a lot of fear around it. And it's like the fear of the unknown, even, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's the conversation that I think people really need to have in order to reshape the culture that's going on around us, is to question those judgments. Where did they come from? Where, you know, how did they form, and are they true? You know, to ask those questions. Are they true? And in your case, obviously no way, right? He sounds like such an amazing person, you know? So it sounds like your book, you talk a lot about him in your book, you know, obviously this is a memoir about your life with him. So, and you keep mentioning it, I want to hear more about your book, Star Child. So tell us a little bit about what it's about, and, you know, a glimpse into it.
Well, I probably wouldn't have written about him had it not been for the fact that I obviously ended up in Uganda, and I miraculously found his family 18 years after he died. The bond was obviously still there. And, you know, I really do believe now, with everything that's happened to me, that there is a continuous thread that connects people even after death. And that is so strong. And, you know, in a country of 43 million people, Uganda at the time, and I found his family.
Wow.
It was like finding a needle in a haystack.
I bet.
And, you know, I had been trying for a number of years to go to Uganda, and nothing was syncing up. It just wasn't working. And I was like, maybe he doesn't want me to go. Maybe the universe doesn't want me to go. Maybe God doesn't want me to go. And then eventually I had been writing a fictional book about this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an agent that was interested in it. And she'd read the book and she said, I can't believe you've not been to Uganda. I want you to go, because I just, you know, I just don't know what you're going to do when you get there, because, you know, it's incredible what you've written and you haven't been there. So I eventually, at that point, everything seemed to sync up for me to go to Uganda. And from the moment I got off the plane till I left, it was like I was a puppet. It was as if somebody had predestined that trip my entire life. The coincidences, the synchronicity, the timing. I could never have planned that. I mean, the people that I met that led me, the book, writing that book led me down a path of interviewing people, meeting people, who it all led to Frankie's family. And I don't want to give everything away, because it is quite a unique
read
story.
The book, right?
Go and buy the book. I'm not going to tell you all here. So, but it's actually just so long to even explain. But, you know, to find the family and to discover that so much of actually what I'd written, the fictional stuff, some of it was actually really true. And then to find his family, and the first person I met was his brother Frank, the same name, who looks like him. And I'm sitting there like with this boy, you know, our man, you know, thinking this was Frankie, Luke, 18 years on, whatever, and can't believe that he's got the same name and looks really like him. And I'm like completely a mess, like
bubbling my head off. You, right?
And this guy's like, you know, what is this white woman doing crying all over me? Like, you know, and so we were kind of joined. The whole family have been uniquely brought together. And, you know, there's a lot of complex emotions there.
Yeah.
They didn't know their mother had given up this child. They'd actually heard 12 years previous and they didn't believe it. They'd heard from this aunt, long complicated story it's in the book. Mm-hmm. So they had an inkling, but they believed that the mother wouldn't do something like that. They would never give up a child. Yeah. So there I am 12 years later coming to put the last piece in the jigsaw and tell them, yeah, it's true. Here you are. You've got a brother. And he lived in Scotland and yeah, he wore a kilt and he ate haggis and, you know, and they're like just blown away by the whole thing. And they've now got a white sister and I've now got three more black brothers and a whole family in Uganda. So it's still unfolding. I'm still getting to know the family and, you know, find out the whole story. But I mean, I'm more or less, I think most of the pieces have been put together. But I think I was definitely meant to go there and I felt very much like Frankie and the mum who had died. Mm-hmm. When Frankie died, I used to say to people, maybe his mum has died and wants him back. And, you know, she died just a few months before him.
Oh, wow.
So wow. I was very nervous that, in a way, if she was alive, part of me wanted to reassure this woman that Frankie had grown up in a loving home and had been okay.
If she had let him go reluctantly, you know, to think, oh no, is he okay? You know, that's always going to be in the back of a mother's mind.
But and I was opening up Pandora's box and I really, mm-hmm. I don't think I ever expected that I really would find them. I don't think I mean, there was the chances of me finding them were so remote that, I mean, I was thinking I'm going for research for the book. And if I can uncover a little bit of anything, you know, really, I mean, I knew I wanted to meet them. That had been right from day one, you know, when that going back to that bathtub moment where I'm like, oh, well, what's Frankie's mom like? Well, what's Africa? You know, I had such an interest in it from such a young age, but I don't think I ever really thought I was going to. And then when the moment presented itself where I thought, oh my gosh, then it's like, what do you do? Do you open Pandora's box and tell these people, or do you just keep it shut? And I walk away back home to Scotland and that's it. So,
Sounds like they needed that connection just as much as you did in a way, like without really realizing it or knowing it. And the way that the universe pulled it together for you, like
it did,
you know, and it's a beautiful story.
It is. And I really think that now on reflection of everything that's happened to me in my life, we're so caught up in trying to control the timing of everything. Mm-hmm. And really, sometimes it's about letting go and letting God.
Yeah.
And I could never have predicted any of this when my parents brought Frankie home, you know, way back then. This has been a lifetime's journey to get to this point. And, you know, 18 years after his death, yeah, I'd wanted to go to Uganda for such a long time. But the timing had to be right. The right people had to be there. Everything had to sync up. And now when I think about the timing of the book, I could never have predicted what was going to happen in the world.
Yeah.
And now people are looking at me like, you know, I know so much about racism and could talk about this and talk. And I'm thinking, yeah, I didn't write the book thinking any of this was going to happen when I wrote the book, because I wrote the book years ago. And as most people that write know, it takes at least about 2 years for the publisher to even publish it once you've written it, like 5 years ago. So there is no way I could have known what was going to happen. If my story can put some positivity out there, can give people some hope, can make people understand that two children like us can grow up completely and utterly loving each other, and that love can transcend borders, time, and even really life itself. Then if the book can do that, that's brilliant.
Yeah. You
know, well, I'm sorry, on you go.
No, it's fine. Well, one of the things I wanted to say that I love so much about this, your story and your experience, your relationship with Frankie is how, and then going to meet his family is how that, you know, he believed he was Scottish in his, you know, and he was by all intents and purposes, he was Scottish. And it's fascinating to me how race is a social construct, you know, it's not, it has nothing to do with, you know, with color or anything. It's literally just what you're socialized into and
social conditioning. Yeah,
exactly. And so it's like, it's a beautiful reminder that if you are racist, okay, I'm going to put this out there. That's a social construct. Okay. And it's, you've been conditioned to believe that, because if this person has lived some certain place or has a certain color, that there's any difference. And we want to honor differences that do exist, honor cultural differences and heritage and all these things that are really beautiful and we love them. But to recognize, look, Frankie was Scottish, and that has nothing to do with color. Your social construct.
It's totally, I don't even know how he would do in Uganda, what he would have thought, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was totally alien to me, and it would have been just as alien to Frankie, even though he was black, mm-hmm. you know, stepping off that plane in Uganda, he would have probably just felt as out of his depth as I did, because it is another world. It's exactly. A fascinating world, and I love it. I love Uganda. But I mean, you'll see that conflict, I guess. Yeah. I have a kind of love-hate relationship with it, because it's so different for mm-hmm. me. And as a white woman trying to navigate there, and some of the difficulties and the corruption and things that you know I've had to kind of navigate my way through, I found it really challenging. But you know, I love the family. I love the fact that, you know, I've got these brothers out there, even though we don't really know that much about each other. That's what's really nice about it, you know. But they accept me as their sister, and they call me their sister. And you know, I get a nice warm feeling about it. You know, it's like, oh, I've got these brothers in Uganda. But at the same time, we really don't, we live completely different lives.
Yeah.
We've never set foot outside of Uganda.
So that's cool.
Mm-hmm. I keep asking Frankie, I feel like he's with me all the time when I'm, well, all the time anyway, but when I'm in Uganda, and he makes it really obvious, and those things are also in the book, how Frankie communicates from the other side to me. I really believe in all of that mm-hmm. because I've experienced so much of it. So he comes through very strongly in Uganda and finds ways of letting me know he's around. So I think, you know, he was with me on that journey. I think Janet, the mother, was with me on the journey. And I don't know where it's going, mm-hmm. but it's just all snowballing, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
It's just remarkable. It really is.
I think that you're right. I love that, you know, with this idea that for people from the other side are impacting your journey, and that they have a message and you have a message that people need to hear. And so that's why it's so beautiful that you've written this book, Star Child. You've written, you know, you're here talking on podcasts and sharing your story. And I just want to thank you, Michaela, and acknowledge you that this is a beautiful story. It's beautiful to know about your relationship with your brother and that you are living his legacy to share that. And that's a powerful message. And it's something that, you know, when people go, I want to live this legacy, or I want to, you know, share this message, you're doing it, and you're doing it the right way, you know, by sharing his story and sharing your experiences. And so thank you for being here, being willing to come and share your story on my show. And, so thank you. Where can we find you and get your book?
Well, Frankie's legacy is really living on through the Star Child charity that we have in Uganda now. So that's the biggest legacy, really. that I've been able to do is have that charity set up in his memory. And we created a school for creative arts there. And we help a lot of vulnerable children and women. So there's a Star Child Charity website, which is starchildcharity.org. There's a lot of information on there as well about the work that we do in Uganda. And then my own website is Michaela.com.
Say that one more time.
MichaelaOnline.com. Okay. And there's the StarChildCharity.org. And, you know, we're very accessible if anybody wants to, you know, ask any more questions. And hopefully they'll pick up the book and read it. Because it's just, I can't even believe that what's happened to me and the journey that this is, you know, what's happened. I'm very keen to hear from people and
awesome.
Open that conversation.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Michaela. Thank you for being on my show. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Glad you were able to tune in for this episode of the Family Culture Movement. Don't miss the next episode with Jennifer Jarrett when she talked about what it's like to raise Black children as a white couple. Again, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Family Culture Movement. Help more people find the show. Download this episode, subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave a review. For more tools for shaping your intentional family culture, be sure to sign up for your free membership of the Family Success Toolbox at homeandfamilyculture.com. Until next time, remember to set your intentions for your family culture and lead your family toward your vision of success.